Today I'm speaking to Irina Miller, co-founder and CEO of Daisy Lab, a New Zealand-based food tech dairy company. Irina and her team are improving the dairy industry with precision fermentation techniques to create animal-free dairy proteins. With a background in biotechnology, Irina has been at the forefront of developing this alternative to traditional dairy, which doesn't compromise on taste or nutrition and is kinder to animals and the planet. Under her leadership, Daisy Lab has made massive strides securing funding and scaling up production. Irina has been working with local dairy farmers, making the most of the dairy processes already in place and getting the best of both worlds for a kinder, more efficient milk production. My name is Alex Crisp and welcome to another episode of Future Foods Interviews, available now on Substack and all podcast channels. Okay, so thank you very much, Irina Miller, co-founder and CEO of Dairy Labs, a New Zealand-based startup specializing in precision fermentation, producing dairy-identical proteins without the use of animals. So, Irina, thank you for coming on. And can you sort of share a little bit of your background and introduce yourself and what inspired you to co-found Daisy Lab?
Right. So I always say that Daisy Lab is a child of frustration. So we are based in New Zealand, the world's largest dairy exporter. So New Zealand produces a lot of dairy, far more than it consumes. And we dominate the global ingredient trade market. So New Zealand covers close to a quarter of that market. So we know dairy ingredients really well because mostly our dairy is shipped overseas in large bags in the form of powder. So we collect the milk and then we often split it into molecules and then powderize it as ingredient and sell it as a commodity. To me, doing the same using precision fermentation always seemed like the most obvious idea. So my background is in business consulting. And then when I left consulting and went to work in the industry, I ended up in the largest dairy company here in New Zealand. It's one of the largest dairy companies globally. I quickly saw the scale, which really overwhelmed me, the scale of just what we're doing in this country, but also what we're doing globally with dairy. And once you see the numbers, for me personally, I couldn't unsee them. So to me, it actually changed the way I look at our food consumption in general. So I always say that that's, you know, working in a dairy industry is what turned me vegan. From the practical business perspective, however, so even putting the sort of animal welfare aside, because we raise lots of cows here in New Zealand. 2 million calves are being slaughtered, male calves being slaughtered every year, just because they're no use in the dairy industry. And it's all quite like, those are quite large numbers. But all of that aside, just looking at a business model and the ingredient trading business model, we collect a rather complicated product from cows that has number of different proteins, number of different fats. It's all kind of all intertwined in a complex matrix. But then we split it into molecules, basically make it into rather simple standardized ingredients. I really couldn't see why we can't just cut to the chase and make those individual ingredients without the cow. And by that, largely reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and obviously not even needing animals, not even needing the cows. So, as I say, idea was so obvious to me. I was certain somebody was going to do it, and I was really frustrated. So I left the dairy industry in 2017, and I was really frustrated that in 4 years nothing was still done in New Zealand, and the industry started developing overseas, but nobody was doing it in New Zealand. And I thought, okay, well, if nobody's doing it, then we're going to. And that's when I found my scientific co-founder. And initially, I guess Daisy Lab really started more as a social project. We just wanted to get something off the ground, get the conversation going. And then we thought, well, we'll just publish the research and we'll let others take it from there. But as we proceeded, we thought, we got kind of more and more confidence. And we thought, well, actually, it is possible to do this in New Zealand. And why don't we?
So, are you the only company doing this in New Zealand now, still?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I was going to ask you to explain the precision fermentation process, but I suppose that's more your partner's expertise.
I
Okay.
can absolutely explain the precision fermentation process. I guess I had a pretty good idea of what the process was like, even before starting Daisy Lab. So I'd had a pretty good understanding of the technical process. I just probably couldn't implement it myself. So I'm not a wet lab scientist.
Okay.
Before Daisy Lab, I never really worked in a lab. So precision fermentation, essentially, we use the process of fermentation, which is very old. For thousands of years, people used friendly microbes to alter flavor or texture profile of familiar foods. So if you think beer, wine, cheese, pickled foods, all of those foods have been processed using fermentation. In our case, we give our friendly microorganisms a specific set of instructions. So we essentially give them a piece of a DNA code that we take from the cow, and we say, please print or please produce this protein using this template. And from there on, the process is the same as brewing beer or making cheese. So microbes eat up the sugars in the media that you put them into. And as they do, they produce this protein of interest, as we call it. So say with wine and beer, they eat up the sugars and they produce alcohol. With cheese, they eat up the sugars and they produce different aromatic compounds. With our process, they eat up the sugars, multiply, grow, and they produce the protein that we've asked them to produce. From there on, the process is actually very similar to processing traditional dairy. So you spin out, so you remove the your microorganism and you're left with clear liquid, which is very similar to dairy whey. So once if you ever made cheese, you separate the curd from the whey. The whey is the liquid that has quite a bit of protein in it still. And then it goes through a process of filtration and purification, just like dairy whey would.
Okay, interesting. So, how do you see this impacting on the future of dairy production? Because you're not producing milk, you are producing elements of milk, right? So, I mean, is this going to be something that's kind of impacts on the industry in some way, or do you think it can kind of alongside it?
I think it's definitely going to impact the industry. I think unless there is some global, massive ethical and philosophical shift, I think dairy will always exist. Unless we just sort of as humanity will come to the idea that we don't want dairy anymore. I think it will exist because you're absolutely right. We're not making milk and we would not even try to make milk. Milk is an incredibly complicated product. Whole mother's body works to make this product for the calf. But as I mentioned before, this is very often not what humans end up consuming. So as this complex product undergo a number of different processing steps, it becomes simpler and simpler and more standardized. So we see our play in the targeted production of ingredients. So and it could be bulk ingredients. We now know very well so that microbes can produce some bulk proteins in milk in a very effective way, so they can do a really good job. They can produce more protein than cows. But also, in where microbes really succeed is in producing some of the very high value, very rare proteins in cow's milk. So, for example, we're working, one of our proteins that we are focused on is lactoferrin. And lactoferrin is incredibly rare in cow's milk. And it's not only rare, it's also very seasonal. So it's a protein that mother's body introduces into the calf's nutrition just as it starts to wean off. So it really is there to boost the immunity. So nutritional value of milk might start declining because milk is particularly nutritionally rich in the beginning of the feeding cycle when you want to grow the baby as fast as possible. But when the baby starts to wean, that's when the very interesting molecules like lactoferrin start to spike. But even during that spike, cow just don't produce a lot of that molecule. This is where precision fermentation can actually produce far more of this protein, and it's a much easier purification process because to extract lactoferrin from cow's milk, it's like pulling a needle out of a haystack. So there's a lot of other things, and it's very rare, and you really have to find it. When you make it using precision fermentation, a bulk of the protein in the liquid is your lactoferrin. So purification is a lot easier. So I think this is where precision fermentation definitely going to disrupt the market is with some of those proteins that are easier for microbes to produce. But also, I think it will eventually cut into some of the bulk protein. But not all proteins. There are some proteins that are harder for microbes to produce than it is for cows. And also, certainly not for the whole milk in a glass product, which of course you can make individual ingredients and then mix it together, but that really isn't commercially viable or logical to be doing this.
Right. So these proteins that you create that are sort of manipulated using sort of the genes of cows, right? Kind of DNA of cows. Are they identical to the proteins which human mothers produce for their children?
Well, they're identical to the proteins that cow mothers produce for their children.
Yes. But
So,
are they identical to the kind of
no,
mother?
they're not identical. They're not identical to humans, so they are cow specific. And this is a very interesting question. It's also a little bit of a philosophical question, really,
Yeah.
because when we started a couple of years ago, we really thought long and hard, well, should we be making cow's milk or should we just cut to the chase and make human milk? Because the process is really the same. And we consciously made the decision to focus on bovine milk because it's a large industry. There's basically two main reasons to today to be focusing on cow's milk. It's a consumer perception. If you explain to an average consumer a process of precision fermentation and say, well, we've produced cow's milk or cow's proteins using this process, and then we produce human proteins using this process, most consumers will say, ooh, to human
Yeah.
milk,
Yeah,
even though
yeah.
it makes very little rational sense because it is, in theory, much better tuned to their body. But because the cow's milk is just something we've grown up with, and it is culturally is just so familiar, consumers will choose cow's milk. I don't think that's gonna be
Yeah.
forever like
I
that.
think it highlights
But there's
perhaps how
interestingly,
strange the whole process is in the first place, doesn't it? Yeah.
correct. But interestingly, there's also regulatory rationale for that because again, it's not rational, and regulators will tell you it's not entirely rational, but it is far easier to get approvals for bovine milk because it is an ingredient that is in wide circulation. far wider than human proteins are. So we know from allergenicity perspective, from how to manage those proteins globally, we know how to work with those proteins. So it's a lot easier to get regulatory approvals for bovine proteins than it is for human proteins. I don't think that's going to be the case forever. I think as precision fermentation develops and diversifies our offering, it's going to definitely start working with human proteins more, and also some, we call them de novo proteins. So entirely new proteins, designer proteins, the proteins that maybe take the best of both worlds, the proteins that are maybe specifically designed to be hyperallergenic. So definitely that's the future, and that's the biggest advantage of this technology, is you can be incredibly flexible and precise with what you're making.
I
It's
suppose
precision.
it's a step too far, isn't it, to be producing human proteins for sort of mass consumption at this stage.
Today it is,
Yeah.
but definitely the most rational segments of the market, like the baby formula, they are looking more and more into human proteins and precision fermentation derived human proteins and other ingredients. So that is definitely a trend that's starting to happen, and I only see it expanding into wider range of products in the future.
Yeah. I mean, is there any truth to the idea that humans have some difficulty digesting cow proteins?
I think it really depends on the human and on their own enzymatic and genetic makeup. I think some humans are a little better in digesting bovine proteins. And again, logically, that would be humans that have grown up with, or descendants of the humans that have grown up with bovine milk as a source of nutrition for like hundreds and thousands of years. If you think about some parts of the planet where our civilizations came from, like for instance, Northern Europe, if you didn't have a cow in the shed over winter, you didn't survive because there was just no other food, right? You could keep maybe potatoes over winter in the in, but not, there's really very, very, very little nutrition. And if you couldn't digest that milk from the cow in the shed, then you probably would, well, get sicker and sicker and not. So it's really an evolutionary selection that unintentionally happened over hundreds and thousands of years for particularly people from colder climates. If you wind back thousands of years ago, I'm sure humans are not designed to digest cow's proteins, but humans have evolved to digest them very well, or some humans have evolved to digest them very well.
Yes, more humans in kind of Northern Europe, I suppose, rather than on in kind of Mediterranean countries is there. So there is a company, I mean, at least one that is making that is producing cultivated milk. So they are trying to produce bioidentical milk. And you said earlier that you wouldn't really see the point in trying to do that. So is that a bad idea?
Not necessarily. It's very different technology. So what we do is we take a template and give it to the yeast. So yeast is the starting cell. Yeast is the organism that then produces one single protein. So for us to make bioidentical milk would mean to list all the ingredients that are in the milk, modify, and there are like hundreds, but even if we cut it to sort of down to top 10 ingredients, top 20 ingredients, we would have to most likely modify 20 different strains of a microbe, produce all of those ingredients individually. Yes, you can maybe co-express some of them, but it's still, it's a huge exercise of producing all of those ingredients, most likely individually, and then combining them together and making sure that they combine and molecules interact in the same way that they do when a cow cell forms forms that liquid. Cellular milk is very different. Cellular milk starts with cow cells or human cells, and they grow the cells similar to what you would do for cellular meat. So you take cells from cow's udder or cells from human breast, and you grow those cells, and those cells multiply, forming a tissue that is very similar to what mammals have. And then you induce those cells to produce milk. And when they do produce milk, it is a lot closer to that bioidentical composition that you would get from a mammal. It is, and I can't comment because it is, I don't know this technology well enough to outline all the kind of hurdles and challenges with it. Generally, it's a newer technology, generally a technology that hasn't yet proven to scale as well as precision fermentation, because precision fermentation has been around for decades. It's actually not a new technology. We produce lots of enzymes, drugs, flavors, number of ingredients this way. So it's kind of been around. It just hasn't really been focused on making bulk proteins previously. But cellular agriculture and cellular meat and cellular milk, I think they're very promising technologies and very exciting technologies. I just probably wouldn't comment to viability and scalability and how quickly it can get there.
Yes. I suppose one of the hurdles you mentioned earlier is the regulatory hurdles. Are there particular problems with your products? I mean, what are the hurdles you have to jump?
Any food product needs to pass a certain regulatory hurdles. If it's a familiar food product that's already in wide circulation, there would be just be hurdles of making sure you produce it in a in the food grade kind of way, that you don't have any contaminants, that it's safe for humans to consume. And those all will apply to us as well. The additional regulatory step that someone like us would need to take is just making sure that we explain and disclose to the regulator how our protein has been produced. We see no, in most countries globally, we see no, well, Europe are European countries are have tighter regulation around ingredients that have been derived with assistance of genetic technology. So yes, absolutely. European market would probably, there's still regulatory pathways to take to get our product approved, but they're probably more lengthy and complex. Many other markets, the regulations or the pathways are already there. We use very safe organism. It's essentially it's used for food production. It's used for making beer. So it's really it's an organism that you can kind of eat. You can consume it straight. And we use a very safe gene that isn't generally causing allergies. So proving the safety of this product is not typically an issue. But then, of course, every country has their own specifics. The trend certainly is moving towards allowing these technologies more and more. So I think that's is becoming less and less of a concern.
So the problem for yours is that it's kind of GMO based products. I spoke to Bon Vivant a few weeks ago or a month ago. Their product isn't GMO as far as I remember. So what's the difference between your process and theirs?
If they use precision fermentation, I'm not sure that there would be many differences in how you define the final product. Our product technically is non-GMO as well, because you remove all the organisms. So our cells secrete the protein outside the cell, just like a mammalian cell would do. So you don't have to break the cell. You don't have to deal with all the DNA and other material that's inside the cell. So you just gently separate the cell from the liquid, and the final product does not contain any organisms, including genetically modified organisms. So the final product is nature identical. So for that reason, that also, but in saying that, we probably wouldn't be saying, like, I wouldn't label my product non-GMO, because I think it's, even though it doesn't have GMOs in it, they were still used, it was still made using genetic technologies. But from the labeling perspective, in many countries, it would not actually require a GMO labeling.
So the market globally, it's been quite hard to raise money over the last couple of years, isn't it? The last 2 or 3 years. And you are going through a fundraising round by all accounts. So has it been easy or quite complicated to raise money? How have you gone about that?
Definitely complicated. Market has absolutely got a lot harder. We smashed all of our goals that we set for the round, the previous round we raised money for, and like overachieved, but in the yield part, fourfold, like four times better than what we said we would do. But we definitely feel that the goalpost has shifted, because when we were pitching raising our seed round, we would never compare ourselves to a commodity dairy ingredient pricing. We saw ourselves in the market, saw precision fermentation is more of a unique new category, new ingredient that there was never really an aspiration or need to compare yourself to dairy. That's definitely turned. So we now need to be showing, well, we can be as cheap as dairy and potentially down the road cheaper than dairy. I think, however, now that we have a lot more confidence in our technology, we also know that that is also achievable. So 3 years ago, when I was pitching for my seed round and we still worked with really small quantities, I probably wouldn't have ever pitched or said, yes, one day we will be cheaper than dairy. Today, it definitely looks a lot more attainable and a lot more, we have a lot more certainty that we will get there one day. Yeah, look, we're always raising. Everyone's always raising. We still have a bit of a runway. We're hoping the market's going to pick up, and as we do, we obviously don't stop working. So we're making new R&D, kind of hitting new R&D milestones and making progress. So we're hoping that it will allow us to raise.
So what tips might you give to other companies trying to raise money in such a complicated, stretched environment?
That is, I would not be taking advice from anyone on how to do it. Look, it really depends on investors and their brief. So I think investors have really reconsidered their investment mandates and briefs and principles that they apply. They want to see, like many investors want to see revenue. Obviously, with technology like ours, we cannot show revenue just yet, or any meaningful revenue. But in other areas, you might be able to. So if you can get a revenue, then I feel like it would help. Apart from that, just articulate what you're good at and hope for the best. Hope that others will get it and it will align with what they are willing to invest into.
So how soon do you expect Daisy Lab to be making revenue?
Daisy Lab pursues a slightly different model, or quite a different model, actually, to most of our competitors. We don't necessarily aspire to be building our own factories. The way we see the industry, there is so much stainless steel that has already been deployed in the dairy industry. It's a huge industry with massive capacities. For precision fermentation to even make a dent in the dairy industry, that means lots and lots and lots of new factories have to be built. And this is problematic because a lot of greenhouse gas emissions are actually being emitted at the time we build a new factory, even if the process in this factory is going to be saving greenhouse gas emissions. So where Daisy Lab really sees the opportunity is to work with the existing dairy producers, use their equipment that they already use for processing, just replacing the upstream. This is what we're saying. We're just replacing the cow and the delivery truck. Everything else, in terms of processing the protein and then your channels of distribution, then the merchandising space that your brands may have already in the stores, everything else stays the same. That just allows you to diversify your supply. And then, of course, because of the by potential and the capability of precision fermentation, that will eventually allow you to diversify your product offering as well. But initially, what I think gets dairy companies that we talk to hooked is that we say, look, you can just install the fermenter inside your factory floor, and it can be working when you need it to work. So, in many parts of the world, milk production is seasonal, and New Zealand is one of those countries. And what it means is that all cows get pregnant about the same time, and then they all start producing milk at the same time, and then milk supply declines at about at the same time. So, roughly 3 months out of the year, capacities are underutilized. That's the time when you can introduce our technology and start initially just supplementing your supply with microbial dairy. You might only be making 5%, 10% of your overall supply. But eventually, once the market shifts, it gives you the opportunity to diversify and put more into precision fermentation. So, with this model, because our, pardon?
No, I was just saying okay.
Right. Okay. So with this model, it would allow us actually to get to revenue a lot faster because, again, we don't have to wait for another large injection of capital. We don't need to build our own factory. We already are talking to a number of dairy companies to whom we would just license our technology. And then at the end of the day, it becomes our revenue stream.
Very interesting. I suppose you already have a lot of contacts in this space anyway, so it's and collaborating with farmers obviously is going to kind of mitigate any kind of bad feeling, kind of thinking that you're sort of stepping on their toes or anything that might happen in that area, you think?
We engage a lot with farmers. Again, being in New Zealand, you can't avoid it. Just about everyone has some sort of connection to dairy. And our farming community is very well educated. It's just the nature, I guess, of New Zealand. So we have really interesting conversations with farmers and we went to a like a our we have a largest farming fair here in New Zealand once a year it happens and we had a stand there past year, and we had lots of interesting conversations. And people ask us incredibly relevant, lucid questions as to, okay, well, how do I diversify? What do I do with my land? Do your microbes need feed? Can I grow crops too? So how do I? So definitely, you can see people start planning how, with time, they might want to transition to other sources of or other ways of farming from dairy farming. And luckily, New Zealand has quite good soils, and there's lots of dairy farms that can actually be transitioned to growing other, and a lot of dairy farms can be transitioned to growing plant-based
Yeah, the feed.
things.
Yeah.
The feed, the fruit, like the human, the food straight for human consumption. I always say, look, I'm not very much qualified to talk about those things, but we're starting to see. I think our government needs to do more, because we are so invested into dairy. We've got just individual farmers and families invested into dairy. So we're starting to see little steps being made towards helping farmers transition and transition kind of ahead of this curve, transition while there's still money coming from dairy. Because if you wait and this technology is successful, and this is the biggest threat for us here in New Zealand, is if this technology is successful and we're not part of it, then there's a big part of our economy gets basically shut down overnight. Because then people can produce the ingredients in market a lot closer to consumer, no need to transport it half like all the way across the globe. And then nobody needs a milk, because we can't do anything with it, with all of those tons and tons of liquid milk that we collect, apart from just making it into powder and shipping it. So there's definitely thinking and moving away from dairy is starting to happen. Probably not as fast as I would prefer it to happen, but I think that's definitely happening. Yeah.
So it's I mean it's a very it's kind of an overwhelming industry to sort of try and break into. Where do you see sort of Daisy Lab in the next 5 to 10 years, your position in that market?
I think we continue to develop different proteins and continue to improve the strains that we already have. So improve the yields on the proteins that we already have. And we work with at least a handful, maybe a dozen of large and medium size and maybe small dairy processors globally, having our technology deployed there successfully. So we enable them to continue to stay relevant and continue to make money, and hopefully see them transitioning more and more into precision fermentation derived ingredients from animal derived ingredients.
And do you sort of see some milestones in the future, like 5% of the market or sort of 10% of the market within a certain amount of years?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I'd like to think that it's going to be incremental, so sort of 5%, 10% over probably the next 10 years. And then it can really switch around. So they can, then it can almost fall off the cliff, so to say. Then it would be like flip, and it will be 60, 70%. It all is, and that's going to happen on price. So for the bulk ingredient, that's going to happen on price. So currently, dairy is the bulk ingredient, and precision fermentation is more of that. How do we reduce greenhouse gas emissions? How do we offer vegan but with the same level of nutrition? But once the price becomes the same or lower, that's when it's going to completely flip. And dairy is going to retain a more of a premium segment where this liquid milk, artisanal cheese, and those kind of products would live, but the bulk protein nutrition would come from other sources. And it's not, I don't think it's just going to be precision fermentation. I think that that switch might happen, and then it might be a combination of plant-based and precision derived. But I think, like, if I had a crystal ball, I'd probably bet on that happening.
Last question. It's been great talking to you. I've really enjoyed meeting you and talking about the progress there. And I just wanted to give you an opportunity at the end to sort of clearly the dairy industry has its kind of negative impacts on the environment as well as so animal welfare and that sort of thing. So how much better for the environment is your technology to what's there now?
So, some studies show that there is up to or even over 90% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. Some studies show more modest greenhouse gas emission reductions, but there are certainly greenhouse gas emission reductions overall. And there is substantial reduction in land use and water use. We're talking like 98% reduction in water and land use. So they're quite substantial positive outcomes from this technology in terms of climate change. If everything else is done right, we obviously don't want to increase food miles with it. We don't want to, as I already mentioned, build too many new factories because then we just produce a lot of greenhouse gas emissions in the beginning. But if we can utilize the existing equipment, then it could be really advantageous.
And those greenhouse gases, they're sort of mainly methane, aren't they?
Yeah, mostly methane, also CO2. I mean, our process produces CO2. Yeast does breathe, so it consumes oxygen and produces CO2. But it is far less, and there's no methane.
Okay.
There's zero methane.
There's Because there's there are steps being taken to try and reduce methane in dairy animals with the introduction of certain additives, and there's the methane hub, which I think is kind of Australian based, isn't it? There's Paul Wood and people like that who are kind of advocates for this thing. So, what do you think of those sorts of steps, movements?
I think it's a great technology if it works. And I know from at least reading, I'm not an expert on those technologies, but reading about them, it makes a lot of sense from the climate change and, greenhouse gas emission reduction perspective. So I'm definitely thumbs up and yes for those technologies because we have to deploy whatever works and anything it takes really to try and reduce our combined greenhouse gas emissions. From more of a vegan animal kind of protectionist activist stance, which is probably more of my personal stance than a Daisy Lab stance. Look, I wish we could leave animals alone as humans, but I also am a realist. I know that it is not possible today with the food system that we have. So I think those technologies are very, very valid and very needed, at least until as humanity we decide to stop farming animals.
Yes. Well, on that note, Irina, I'd like to say thank you very much. And it's been wonderful talking to you, and I'll let you get on with the rest of your day. Thank you for talking on Future Foods interviews.
Thank you, Alex. It was my pleasure to be here.